Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Welcome everybody to episode 122 of the podcast. Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel with you here. Andrew, now we're as guilty as anybody of this, but so often car media is just full of articles, podcast videos on the cars that you should buy.
Yeah, buy this, buy that. Yeah.
Yeah, if you've got...
We're not going to do that today.
No, we're not. And we spoke about it last week, didn't we? So last week, the whole thing was about how to spend £20,000 on a used car. And we had the idea for this episode during that recording. And we said we should do one all about the cars you shouldn't buy, because people like us so rarely talk about that stuff. So we're flipping the usual sort of car journalist thing on its head and trotting through a whole load of cars that for various different reasons you really shouldn't be spending your money on. Before we do that, though, let's have a little trot through some of the articles that we've been posting on the app and on the website. The one that's gone up this morning, I'm delighted with. It's another Ian Callum piece, all about the Aston Martins that he's contributed to over the years. And what he's doing beautifully for us now is telling the backstory that actually I don't think has been told before. And you learn so much about the process of car design, and particularly pitching new models to big OEMs. It's just a great insight, isn't it?
And also, you know, we have with Aston Martin and other companies, you know, journalists report on their understanding of what went on. And of course, yeah, that's fine, but it's always one step removed. And there are Chinese whispers and things get misinterpreted and misunderstood. And, you know, to have it literally from the bloke who was doing it, you know, it couldn't be more firsthand. And, you know, the fantastic thing about this story is, you know, well, we know obviously that Ian did the DB7 and he did the Vanquish and he did 99% of the DB9. But it's stuff like the mid-engine Vantage, that the Vantage was always going to be a mid-engine car. And Ian did that before he did the DB9. And because the Vantage turned up with its engine in the front after the DB9, we always kind of think of it as being a derivative of DB9. It wasn't at all. It came first, and Ian did it. And then it was only when, I don't spoil the story, but, you know, there was a sort of change at the top, and decisions were made, and, yeah. So, and, you know, the luxury Ford Taurus-based Aston Martin that was mooted, and the Lagonda that he did, and, you know, all this stuff, which you just don't hear about. And it's all there. It's absolutely fascinating. It's, you know, there are so many cars that, and you sort of think about them and you think, oh, what if they'd actually made it? How different would the company be? I mean, Aston Martin is obviously, you know, heavily into mid-engine cars now, not just with with the Valkyrie and the Valhalla coming, but you know, we know that the new Vanquish is going to be a mid-engine two-seat car to rival, you know, cars like the 296 GTB and that sort of thing. And you know, there was Ian saying this is the kind of car, designing that kind of car, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah,
it's fascinating. It's absolutely riveting stuff.
It really is. And some lovely images as well. And he's showing the cars to us, and some of those images haven't been seen before. So it's definitely worth checking out that piece. The Aston's I Created, it's called. We've also got a two-part series from Andrew English about reviving iconic brands, how to do it, why you shouldn't do it. It's just a typically thorough Andrew English piece. Again, insightful and revealing. And he looks at what's going on in the motorbike world as well as a kind of parallel to what's been happening in the car world. Go and check that out. We've also got another David Tuig piece. Almost Great is this series that he's been writing for us, among others, where he looks at cars that are not quite great of the industry. And this one's about the Porsche 928, which actually he confesses. Sorry,
no, it isn't. No, it's not. It's about the 924.
It's about the Porsche 924. Sorry, that's a mistake in my notes rather than anything else. It's about the Porsche 924, and he admits that this is the kind of car that should appeal to him because it's a sports car, but also it's a sports car built to a budget, and some engineers would, you'd imagine, shy away from that kind of challenge. But David loves it because it's more discipline, and presumably it also means that more people can afford to buy the thing, which is important to him.
What really interested me about that story was, you know, I always just thought the 924 was just this sort of poor apology for a car. And then actually, if you sort of read David's piece and you look at how it's configured and the motivation behind it and what they actually achieved, with this transaxle car with a gearbox between the rear wheels and the weight distribution, it was actually a pretty purely conceived car. It was Almost Great. It was actually, you know, it's strange because you think Almost Great, well, not, you know, not as good as you'd expected. This car, it actually was, for me, a car that, having read David's piece, I actually have greater admiration for. So I kind of came at it from the other direction. But, you know, whatever your view of it, it's a fascinating piece.
Mm. And actually, it did inspire a run of Porsches, front-engine Porsches, some of which were great.
Absolutely. So all those cars, you know, your 968 Club Sport, you know, is a 924++++.
Mm. Yeah, that's where it came from. So another piece, and actually I think it's the most read piece we've put up recently, is also a very sad one for me, but a happy one as well, because my Alpine A110 is going. After almost 3 years, 17,000 miles, it does have to go. And you'll have to check out the story in the app or on the website to find out exactly why.
It's because you hated it, wasn't it?
Absolutely terrible.
Most disappointing thing you've ever driven.
I've been lying all along.
Always break down. Never completed the journey without leaving it a steaming wreck at the side of the road.
Andrew Frankel's a naughty man.
Terrible car.
Don't listen to him. Not one word. You'll have to find out, read the piece to find out why, but the time has come. And I was, do you know what? The interest that piece got really took me by surprise. Although every time I've written about the car, it's got a good response. People really seem to be interested in that thing, and interested in a real ownership experience as well. Thanks everyone who read the piece and got involved.
And make them an offer.
Well, that is the other thing I was going to say. It's on the market. If someone's looking for a lovely mint A110, get in touch.
One very careful owner.
One very careful
owner,
indeed.
Who other than you has driven that car?
Do you know what? It's a good roster of people. You have driven it. Chris Harris has driven it. Kieran Chandock has driven it. And you've all said very, very charming things about the car. So
it
can't be that bad,
can it?
Pretty much, yeah.
It's not terrible, is it?
I think a mate.
Forget me, but you know.
I think a mate has driven it. And then maybe Alpine people, but yeah, that's not bad. Yeah. All right.
It is a good car.
Okay, and make me an offer, please. Thank you. So let's talk about the cars that you shouldn't buy rather than the cars that you definitely should buy, my Alpine. I think
there are two categories here.
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
Do you want to explain? I think I've got some different categories, but I like
yours. Okay, so the way this story unfolded in my brain was it started off as being cars that you'd really like to buy, but in theory, in your heart, but actually if you went and did it, they would end up bleeding you white. They'd just turn into complete nightmares.
Yeah.
But then I thought there's this whole other kind of car, which I can't really imagine why anybody would want to buy. And yet, if you look at the prices asked for them, they're completely bonkers. Mm-hmm. So they're two completely... Yeah, so, you know, there are cars you want but shouldn't buy, and cars you don't want but people for some reason do and spend huge amounts of money on them. So that's kind of like... Yeah, that's how it divides down for me. But you've got something else on your mind.
Yeah, so I've looked at it a slightly different way. And I will reveal that in a moment. I've got some specific examples as well that I'm going to run through. But
can I just say, I think that all the cars we're going to talk about, they're not just sort of us putting fingers in air, are they? I mean, these are all individual cars that are for sale now, with price tags on them. So this is the here and now. This isn't just, you know, journalists endlessly speculating.
We've actually done a little bit of research. So do you want to maybe to get us underway? Can you give us a stupidly expensive crap car, please?
Yeah. A Mark 3... Mark 4. Ford Escort RS Turbo.
Yes.
1984. £32,500. So this is a front-wheel drive Ford Escort, which was a terrible car when it was new. I know, I was around. I was driving them. £32,500. I mean, if you look through the listings, you know, we all know that Mark II Escorts are revered and the supply is running out because lots of them rusted and the rest have all been turned into rally cars. But Mark II Escorts, you can find Mark II Escorts out there, and I'm not talking about, you know, original, you know, BDA engine RS whatever, 1600s or 1800s. You know, you're talking about Mark II Escorts, which costs £50,000 now. And I just find that astonishing. But I don't find it as astonishing as a front-wheel drive Escort, an RS Turbo, for £32,500. I mean, on what kind of world is that any kind of good idea? Maybe there's something I missed about these things. I'm not sure it's in terribly good condition, but I just don't understand it.
So, we've seen some cars, particularly sort of 80s stuff, often hot hatches or, you know, blue collar performance cars that have gone bananas in terms of values in recent years, in the last decade or something. And I think it's the explanation is that these are people who lusted after these cars in their teenage years or, you know, early adulthood in the 80s when they were new, and only now can they afford them. And that's driven values up really sharply, which is fine, but it still doesn't, you're not getting 30 whatever thousand pounds worth of car for that money, are you? It's not a
one thing I can tell you, which is a hard and fast rule that I think applies to all cars, is that if they weren't good when they're new, they never somehow become good over time. Just because they're old doesn't make them classic. A rubbish new car 20 years down the road is a rubbish old car. End of.
True, including the Escort RS Turbo. Well, do you know, I'm glad you started with that one because I'm going to give you one of mine. Mine's a 1985 Ford Escort RS Turbo. Same car. But this is actually a slightly different category because this is Princess Diana's old car. It's up for sale at Silverstone Auction soon with no reserve. So we'll have to wait and see what it goes for. But I'm proposing a different type of car that you probably shouldn't buy. And that's the one with a celebrity or famous former owner. Do you agree with me that it's actually just a waste of money?
For me, well, I suppose to an extent.
It depends who.
I can see Steve McQueen heading in the direction of this conversation. But
yeah.
I suppose it depends. Who, I mean, if there was, you know, a car that, I don't know, Peter Revson or Mark Donohue or one of my heroes had owned, I think it would get in the way because I think it would actually make me want to drive it less rather than more. And I don't know. I mean, the fact that Diana had owned a car is absolutely neither here nor there to me at all. It would really make absolutely no difference whatever. I'm just not that interested in that sort of thing. I'm just interested in how they drive. But I do like cars with interesting histories. So, you know, I like cars that, you know, if they've had, you know, particularly racing cars, if they've done Le Mans or, you know, done interesting stuff, then that does interest me because I like, you know, I've been very lucky, for instance, to drive, you know, Bentley's Team Blower, which is a very, very original car. And I like sitting there and thinking, these are the pedals that Tim Birkin pressed. This is the steering wheel he held. Those are the instruments he looked at while he was thundering down the Mulsanne straight at 125 miles an hour in 1930. I like that. But I like it because that's actually, for me, more about the car. And the fact that I'm, you know, sitting there and doing all those things. But the fact that, you know, Lady Diana or anybody else had owned a terrible car, absolutely no interest to me at all.
I often see cars listed online as formerly owned by David Beckham or someone of that ilk, you know, proper pop culture sports person or celebrity. And the dealers are expecting some sort of premium, and I just don't understand. You know, it is different if, as you say, if they are heroes of the car world or the racing world, I think that makes a difference. But just some random celebrity, just because they happen to have owned it, it doesn't mean you should rush out and go and buy this car. You know, it doesn't improve the experience.
The other thing with those cars is, I do have a specific example in my mind, but I probably won't mention names because I could get into trouble. But okay, so I know that there was a car that got given away in a competition in a magazine. And the big hook behind this car was that it had been owned by someone unbelievably famous. Okay? That was the big hook. I also happen to know that unbelievably famous person owned that car for approximately 30 seconds.
God.
Or for as long as it took for a photographer to take a picture of the person standing by the car and for his or her name to be on the V5. They never drove it. They owned it in the most technical term only for the shortest period of time it is possible to own a car. And it was done simply to pump up its value so it could be a worthwhile competition winning thing. Because frankly, the car on its own wouldn't have been worth giving away. So I think you need to be careful about that sort of stuff, isn't it? You know, if you are really into it, I mean, you know, it's one thing, isn't it? If it's I think there's a car which is up for sale, I can't remember what it was, but which Clark Gable owned for 30 years. You know, fair enough. You know, clearly that was Clark Gable's car. But sometimes these are smoke and mirrors jobs, aren't they? And the celebrity's probably, you know, being paid to do this. And, you know, as I say, it's ownership only in the most technical sense.
Yeah, avoid, as far as I'm concerned. Okay, can we have one of yours, please?
Okay. A 1997 TVR Cerbera. Okay?
Go on.
Get this. With a Maserati engine in it.
Oh, my God.
Which has done 100,000 miles. And they want £54,000 for it.
So that TVR would have had the Rover V8, would it?
It could have had a V8 or it could have had an Al Melling V8 in it. It could have had, I don't know which what it would have had originally in it, but it hasn't got either of them in it now. It's got a 4.7 litre. It's got an engine out of a Gran Turismo or a Gran Cabrio or one of those. You know, it's the Maserati normally aspirated V8 engine, which is it's a good engine. But it doesn't belong under the bonnet of a TVR and it doesn't make it worth £54,000. And I just,
It is curious, isn't it, the amount of work people put into these sort of Frankenstein cars.
Yeah.
For what?
I
suppose it's a lovely engine, isn't it? Maybe it sounds good. I'm sure it does.
I mean, maybe it was an original Al Melling V8, and it went bang because, you know, we know that on occasion they did that. And they just thought, well, rather than get another one, I don't know, this is pure speculation on my part, but maybe they thought, oh, we'll get an engine which won't go bang, which is the same sort of size, makes the same sort of noise. Wouldn't have the same sort of power, though, would it? As compared to a 4.5-litre Cerber engine, wouldn't have... But that, I mean, I don't think that had 450 horsepower.
Did it? Wow.
Bloody hell. The Cerber was a proper... Yeah, they were properly powerful things.
And what do they want? 50-something thousand pounds for it?
£54,000.
Yeah, that's a stretch.
And, and the car's done 100,000 miles. 20 of them on that engine. So one thing I would say, just while we're on the subject of TVRs, we have, as have many other journalists, sort of, you know, taken the mick out of TVRs and the reliability over time. I think they are actually genuinely, and I know this isn't the thrust of this podcast, but I think they are becoming better buys, because the fact that they are old and a bit sort of rubbish at times is mattering less now they're becoming classics. I think when they were new or nearly new, and you kind of compare them to what else was around at the time, I always found their case very hard to make. But now that, you know, something like a Griffith from the mid sort of 1990s, I think it's actually a charming looking car. And I think the really important point is that the fact it was probably built quite badly when it was new doesn't matter anymore, because everything that was built badly would have fallen off and broken and been put back by presumably somebody who knew what they were doing. And the basics in those cars, if you get particularly cars from the pre-Al Melling era, with BorgWarner gearboxes and Rover V8 engines, they're just, you know, and they've got strong backbone chassis and they've got glass fibre bodies which won't rust. I mean, they're actually, you know, they're probably not that difficult to maintain and they probably won't go wrong that often. So, yeah. Anyway, so I just thought I'd pitch that in there.
I drove a Camaro a couple of years ago. And I think you mentioned this on the podcast. You were surprised at how classic it felt rather than... Yeah. Modern classic or like a modern sports car. And I thought exactly the same. It felt like it was 20 years older than it really was. But maybe...
I thought they were close... It felt more in time and feel. It felt more closely related to an Austin Healey than a modern car.
Yeah.
When they were new, that was a terrible thing. But now, actually, it's very charming.
Part of the appeal, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right, let me give you another one of mine then. And this is another category of car that, as far as I'm concerned... you shouldn't get involved with. Okay, this is a brand new Range Rover. It's a new model. It's a P530, a V8 one, first edition, and it's done very few miles. How many miles has it done? I don't know. Basically delivery miles. Up for £181,000.
Oh, my goodness.
This is a £141,000 car. There'll be some options on there, I suppose, but you're paying a 40 grand premium just to have it now. You will never get that money back. Once the market is flooded with cars, as production ramps up and people start moving them on, the value
and the
of that
chip
car,
prices goes away, which it will.
Yeah, the value of that car just drops to the level of any other comparable car. And that 40 grand premium that you paid because you couldn't be bothered to wait is gone.
Yeah. And there's a lot of this going on at the moment because, as we all know, cars are in very short supply.
Yeah.
And particularly, you know, expensive cars which need lots and lots and lots of chips in them. So if you've got one, you know, you will probably be able to persuade someone to pay more money for it than you've paid yourself. So you can flip it. You're absolutely right. Don't do it. You know, wait. Well, I mean, you know, do it, but do it with your eyes open because,
know,
that Range Rover, you'll lose... Unless you can find someone to flip it onto, but you won't be able to because you already paid 180 grand for it. You know, you will lose tens of thousands of pounds driving it out of the showroom.
And do you know what?
Or if that bloke's drive forever.
There'll be multi-millionaires out there who just don't care. They just want this new thing. And that's kind of fine.
And that's fine.
That's up to them, isn't it? By and large, getting involved with the Overs thing, the Overs market, I don't understand. I sort of get it for particular cars, you know? When the 911R was new, the Overs market was bananas for that thing. Actually, I think that got out of control, but there was such a particular appeal. It was such a special car that maybe it kind of makes sense. And actually, they've held on to a lot of that value, haven't they? But something like a Range Rover.
But if it's a limited edition car, which is known to be special, and it's not just some marketing exercise, and there are genuinely more people who want them than there are cars in existence, then, you know, my schoolboy economics tells me that, you know, supply and demand meet at the price. And that therefore, you know, people will pay more for that. And if you want one, that's what you're going to have to do. But it's simply not the case with a Range Rover. And we're not singling out Land Rover here. It's with all cars like that. You know, the demand will be satisfied.
It will.
The supply will be restored and the price will come down. It's basic economics. So, you know, if you're going to do it with your eyes open. Do not think that because you've got something which not very many other people have at the moment, that makes it a sound investment. It doesn't, because, you know, not long from now, you know, the market will become... Yeah, and the other thing is that, you know, we often get, don't we? And we saw that, we saw this with, well, I mean, McLaren did it and Bentley did it in the early 2000s, is you get a company which has a car it can sell. I'm talking about, you know, things like the Continental GT and cars like the McLaren, you know, the 650S and the 570S and that sort of thing. And, you know, because they spend a lot of money developing these cars, they suddenly think, wow, we can sell these things. And so there is a period when, because these are very new cars onto the market and there aren't many around, they are quite valuable. But then what the manufacturer does is think, whoopee, we can make lots of these, and they flood the market. And then, you know, suddenly the thing which you thought was a smart investment because it was rare and it was special and it was interesting and everybody's saying whizzy things about it, suddenly there are just loads of them around. And, you know, it's not the investment that you thought it was. And, you know, and it becomes a depreciation. And, you know, it's difficult. It's difficult. It really is. So, don't do it.
I think even people with means don't like getting their fingers burned, do they? That's why they have means, because they're careful. I'm glad you agree with me on that one. Right, let's have one of yours.
Let me do one.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is an example of don't buy the wrong car from the right brand. Okay? So don't think to yourself, I want a such and such, but you can't really afford it, so you can get the cheapest possible one you can. Okay? So an example I've got here is a Ferrari Mondial 8. which you can currently buy for £33,000, which probably doesn't sound very much money to spend on a Ferrari. Now, the days of 10 grand Ferraris are gone. You used to be able to do it. You used to be able to spend £10,000 on an automatic 412, no, not a 400i. And, you know, that would have been, you know, the bills that you get on that. I mean, if ever there was an example of the cheapest cars becoming the most expensive, that would have been it. This isn't that, because, you know, Mondial 8s don't have any particular horror stories behind them, whatever. But they're just not very good cars. 214 horsepower in quite a big 2+2 Ferrari. You know, in the US, they had even less power than that because of emissions stuff. They were struggling to get much under 10 seconds to 60. Like sort of maybe late eights, something like that. And they really struggled to do 130 miles an hour. So, you know, they're Ferraris in name, but not much more than that, because they really can't get out their own way. The later Mondials, the QVs and the 3.2s, are a lot better. But, you know, the cheapest Ferrari you can buy at the moment, which is in any kind of sensible condition, is a Mondial 8. And it's cheap for a reason. Because it was just a, you know, it was a car that came along. Two things happened. One, Ferrari needed a 2+2, and it was it. And it was also came along at the time when suddenly people had to get serious about emissions, and power was strangled. And that engine, that 3-litre V8 engine, had much more power in the 1970s, in 308s and that sort of thing. But they had to put fuel injection on it, and that just killed it. 214 horsepower Ferrari. It's not great, is it?
So, yeah, it's a really good example, because you think you're buying into the Ferrari legend, don't you? You think, aha, it's a prancing horse. I'm going to experience what it's like to own a Ferrari. But by the sounds of it, you're actually going to experience something slightly different.
Yeah.
Good one.
Yeah.
Right, let me give you another one of mine. And this is another example of a category that's perhaps best avoided, which is the cheapest example of something available. So that's a bit of a sort of social media or YouTube trope. I bought the cheapest such and such in the country. Let's find out how badly wrong it goes. And the issue is that, as we've said so many times before, with a certain type of car, the cheapest example will often turn out to be the most expensive, because it's cheap for a reason, isn't it? It's leggy, or it's had a load of owners, or it's not been properly maintained, or it's got a fault that's coming over the horizon towards you that's going to cost a fortune. And it's so often worth holding out, traveling a bit further, spending a little bit more for an example that's been really beautifully cared for and has really robust history. So having said that, I've got a couple of examples here that there are probably better examples of this, but I was intrigued by this one. This is the cheapest McLaren currently for sale in the UK, certainly on Auto Trader. It's a 2012 12C, so it's an early car.
Yeah.
36,000 miles, 66 grand.
You see, I quite like the idea of that.
See, this is it's had 5+ owners. So we don't know exactly how many owners. It's an intriguing one, isn't it? I think there are other cars that could give you so much more grief if you just went out and bought the cheapest one because you were desperate to have one of those. But I do wonder if this McLaren might actually be okay. I don't know.
Murky 66 grand. The problem with those cars, particularly those early McLarens, is, you know, they were really quite specialist bits of kit. You know, with that, you know, that interconnected semi-active suspension system and so on. And, you know, if they can't even tell you how many people have owned, you know, so that car is a 2012 car, so it's 10 years old. So, and it's had 5+ owners. So at a frequency of absolutely no less than once every other year, so whoever's had that car has moved it on. Yeah, run.
It would be okay. Another example of the same thing: the cheapest DB9 I could find, £25,000. It's not a lot of money for a beautiful car.
For a beautiful V12, Callum Aston Martin,
450 horsepower.
Yeah,
it's done 96,000 miles.
You see, I mean, it might be all right. It probably won't be, but it, you know, it, to me, so much with a car like that, so much of that just depends on the history. If the history is known, and you know, if it's belonged to one person, and all he or she has done is gently toddle up and down the motorway in it for some whatever reason, then it'd probably be all right. But if it's had 15 owners and you don't know where it's been and half the history's missing, run a bloody mile. So, I mean, to me, cars like that, they can be both things. They can either be, you know, cars that you should avoid like a pint of time-expired prawns, or they should be cars that, you know, should be embraced and cherished because it can go both ways. They can be dreams and they can be nightmares. And, you know, the job is figuring out which, isn't it? But, I mean, they're always going to be a punt.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. It is a punt. That is the right word. Give us another one.
Okay, so this is another category. Okay, these are old cars that have done no miles.
Ah, yeah.
Okay.
Concerning.
So there are two things with these sorts of cars that happen. Firstly, people charge an extraordinary amount of money for these cars because they've done no miles. Secondly, if they've done no miles, things don't stop aging just because they're not doing anything. Actually, you know, as any classic car owner will tell you, until, you know, you die of boredom, the worst thing you can do to an old car is leave it. Yeah, because they just seize up. And, you know, and even if, you know, it doesn't, even if the engine or the gearbox or something big doesn't seize, you know, all the bits of rubber in it, all the unions, everything just, you know, all the bushings, all the
seals,
joints, seals, yeah, they just don't like standing around. You know, they need to be lubricated. They need to be used. They need to be moved. And so, okay, so the example I've got here, okay, it's an Escort Cosworth. I think 93 Escort Cosworth. I think, I'm trying to remember now, I think it's done 217 miles in nearly 30 years. And they want £150,000.
Yeah, so...
And there's something else. The biggest thing is, the only appeal of that car And the only reason anybody might pay that kind of insane money for it is because it's done no miles.
Yeah.
So then what you're doing is you're buying a car you can't use. Because the moment you use it, you're destroying the only thing it's got going for it. Because if you put miles on it, it's no longer a car. So unless you are a museum curator looking for... And if you're a museum curator, frankly, you wouldn't buy an Ascot Cosworth because they weren't very good cars. They look amazing. They're wonderful looking cars, but they were never as nice a driver as a Sierra Cosworth. I always thought that they were, as cars, I thought they were incredible. It's one of the most overrated cars out there. And to pay £150,000, you must always think about what else could you do with that money. There's so much you could think of. The GT3 you could buy for that. So a 0 miles car, or a car that's done less than 10 miles a year for that, just don't do it. Unless all you really want to do, if you're the sort of hoarder that wants to stick it in a dehumidified air-conditioned garage with a cover over it and go in there late at night with your glass of whiskey and have a look at it and do whatever you're going to... if that's really how you enjoy your car, then that's absolutely fine. But
it's not for you, is it?
It's about as far from me as you could possibly get.
Yeah, I agree. as an enthusiast or someone who actually wants to use the car, you'd be better off with one that's been used regularly and properly cared for. That's what you're looking for.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Low miles, not no miles.
Yeah. Right. I want to give you one of mine because I just stumbled upon it. I don't think it really slots into any particular category. but it's a Land Rover Defender. It's a previous shape one, not the new one. And it's listed as a 2018 car, which... I don't think that can be right, can it?
It might have been registered that, but it certainly wasn't built then.
Okay, so this is a 6x6 conversion. So it's got 3 axles, 6 wheels. So it looks fairly striking. It's built by the Chelsea Truck Company. And actually, I don't have a problem at all with what the Chelsea Truck Company do. You know, they build slightly tarted up Defenders and Wranglers and that sort of thing, and they do what they do, and I'm sure people who buy them love them. That's fine. But I actually drove this car, this exact car, a few years ago. It was dreadful. It weighs so much. It had the 4-cylinder diesel engine with no go whatsoever. You were almost flat to the boards just to get the thing rolling. It was noisy. It was...
Yeah.
Annoyingly long, and they want £500,000 for it.
Oh my god. Sorry, I thought you just said £500,000, but you clearly didn't.
I actually did. I still wonder if it's a typo.
£500,000. Well, I mean, there's a bit of me that admires that because you can ask whatever you like, can't you?
Yeah, you can. It's a one off.
£500,000. Yes.
Yeah.
So that deservedly was rare.
And let's keep it that way. So I just wanted to give that example because it amused me. But I've got a couple of others that slot into one of the categories that you mentioned earlier, which is the way I found these two cars, I got on the classifieds and I searched for V12 powered cars for less than 10 grand. And I found 16 or 17 of them. And the one that I have here is...
I'm trying to work out what they are.
Yeah.
Benzes and things like that.
Yeah. So this one
is a Daimler double sixes.
This one is a Mercedes CL 2002 car, a CL 600, so 6 litre V12 with 367 horsepower. That's an unstressed engine. And it's £7,000.
Okay, let me try and defend it.
Go on.
You know, it's just a bit too expensive for that. Because if it was, I'm a believer in the disposable car. Okay, so I think there are cars which sound amazing, and which you can buy for buttons because they're so old and so knackered and everything else, and you just take the view that you've already lost the money, and so you write it off to nothing in your head. before it even arrives, and then you drive it for as long as it lasts, and then when that light appears on the dashboard, you throw it away. And you might get lucky, and you might not. You might have a car which lasts you a couple of years, at which stage you are absolutely quids in. You might have one which lasts you 10 minutes, at which stage you haven't lost a huge amount of money. £7,000 is a bit too much to fit into that, isn't it? I mean, that's going to hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is going to sting a little bit, just having to write off £7,000. So the other one that slots into this category is a 2006 BMW 7 Series, a 760 Li. So again, a V12. That's 10 grand. So that's really not disposable money.
No.
And the thing about these cars is that, okay, so I've, in the last year or so, had renovated a house. We bought a very, very tatty three-bedroom house. And we renovated it, and it cost a load of money. And it's, we're delighted with the results. It's lovely inside. But there are things like the windows. You know, we're not going to replace the windows that we don't like, because it's too expensive to do it. We're not going to make it look beautiful from the outside, because it's too expensive to do it. So that, you know, we're not going to take it from a total basket case to beautifully finish, because it's just too expensive. If we'd had the money to be able to renovate it top to bottom, inside and out, we would have bought a different house instead, because we'd have been able to afford it, you know? So my theory with a house like the one we bought is that it actually takes two separate owners to get it all the way up to scratch, because you need two people to come in and spend a load of money on it to get it to that point. One person isn't going to do it because they would have bought a different house in the first place. And so my theory with these cars as well is that if you can afford to run them, or if you can afford to write off that money, or if you can afford, when that big bill does come along, probably you're just going to buy a different car in the first place, because you can afford to do so. So these cars kind of fit into a weird kind of category where, in my mind, the only people who buy them are those who take a bit of a punt, get burnt, and probably don't do it again.
Because you have to think about, you know, sooner or later you're going to try and sell it to someone. And they all go through exactly that thought process. And actually, there aren't that many people who are prepared to chance what is still, you know, a reasonable sum of money on a car which is, frankly, likely to cost them a lot. When it's not in itself, you know, I mean, actually, I think a CL600s, when they were new, I thought they were pretty good things. But it's never going to be an icon, is it? It's never going to be a sort of legendary car. It's never going to be an appreciating asset. So, you're absolutely right.
It just feels like the CL in particular now only makes sense for people trying to make a story out of buying it. You know, if you've got a YouTube channel or you're a whatever, you've got a car blog or something, there's a story there. But
yeah, but it's the wrong price, isn't it? Because £7,000 isn't a lot of money to pay for one of those, but it's not such a surprising amount of money. People are going to prick up their ears and go, I'm sorry,
yeah,
£7,000?
Yeah, it's true.
A knackered old, it's the wrong money. If it were 1,500 quid, you're thinking, oh, okay.
Let's have a look.
That's interesting. Yeah.
It would be interesting having a big V12 on your driveway, though.
Yeah.
I am sort of drawn to that.
Leaking out the bottom of it, which you can't from some untraceable leak.
Yeah.
Okay.
Avoid.
Can I have a go?
Yeah.
Okay. So this next car is the sort of, however much buying an older car is a sort of a bit of a leap of faith and a sort of heart over head type of decision, never ever abandon yourself entirely to what you really want, and spend a huge amount of money for a car which isn't very good or is in fact completely awful. So you want a convertible Aston Martin, an old, beautiful, not from the sort of mass-produced era, but from the hand-built era. I mean, it just sounds like the most perfect thing to go wafting around in. So you end up spending £100,000 on a 1996 Virage Volante. Now,
ooh,
the Virage Volante is one of the worst cars I've ever driven. It's absolutely appalling. What and this one's automatic.
Oh, God. What specifically is wrong with that car? Everything?
Pretty much. So much scuttle shake.
Yeah.
That they don't ride or handle at all. That engine, that 5.3 litre V8, which is really old by then, they had to, I think they must have put a load of additional strength in it, because even in the standard Virage, it was never a fast car, but it was slower than ever in the convertible. And with that automatic gearbox, it might even be a three-speeder. It's certainly not modern than four, but it's one of, I think it's one of those sort of old GM slush-matic terrible things. So what you have is you have an Aston Martin that doesn't go, it doesn't steer, it doesn't handle, it doesn't ride, it rattles about all over the place. Well, it was. I can remember when I can still remember when I first drove one, and just thinking, I mean, okay, my expectations weren't high because the Virage wasn't a great car, but there aren't many cars which have suffered more for having their roofs chopped off than that. And it is the ultimate in sort of, you know, self-indulgent cars that you, oh, the only reason you have a car like that is because you wanted to be seen in it. And if you really want to be seen in a Virage Volante, you don't have to spend £100,000 on one. You can spend half that money. But even at half that money, you know, fundamentally to me, a bad car is worth no amount of money because it's a bad car. And this is not only a bad car, it's a really expensive, really bad car.
Yeah, it's, again, it's not the dream that you think you're buying into, is it? It's something
at
quite
all.
Different.
At all. Yeah.
Good one. Have you got any more?
Yeah. Like, I won't go on.
You've run me out.
I've got lots more, but there's one more kind of car, which is just the really cheap sort of, and you can find these cars, they've all got terms attached to them, like could benefit from some light recommissioning.
Sure.
Yes. Right. Which, by what you mean, is box of bits.
Non-runner, yeah.
And sometimes they look superficially plausible. So for instance, there's one here I've got. There's a 1991 Bentley Mulsanne S.
Oof, yeah.
Okay? Big saloon. Massive V8 engine. $4,000. Yeah, it's work. It works. It's clinging to an MOT, but it's like, I mean, I suppose on my disposable car basis, it doesn't matter that very much. But you know, it's just like, I mean, that would just be a ticking time bomb. I mean, and the problem with people always think about, I think they kind of convince themselves that, I don't know, because the engines are quite lazy and quite strong, and they have these American gearboxes in them, which, you know, are pretty simple and that sort of thing. But, you know, the one word we haven't mentioned in this podcast so far is rust. And actually, that's what kills these cars. Even if it is mechanically sound, it's a Bentley, it's 30 years old, you know, it's cost £4,000, which means that no one is going to, you know, have looked after it. Or it's unlikely to have been. I mean, unless it has got an incontrovertible history showing that it has been pampered to within an inch of its life for every day of its existence to date. I mean, I'm not actually saying don't buy it, but what I am saying is go into it as a sort of, well, either spend nothing on it and throw it away when it goes wrong, or just have your eyes wide open. I mean, some people do this. I mean, there are people who, I can remember talking to an Alvis dealer and restorer, and somebody just delivered a car to them in cardboard boxes, literally in boxes. It was the ultimate barn find. And they said they were going to completely rebuild the car into some Alvis saloon from the 1930s. And I knew that car then would probably be worth about £30,000-£40,000. I said, I don't understand how you can do that for the money. And they said, well, you can't. Then we're going to spend about £100,000 doing it. And at the end of it, he's going to have a car that's worth about £30,000-£40,000. And I said, well, he knows this. He knows this, and he's happy with it because he wants what he wants, that car. And there are, you know, and there are some people who are prepared to spend huge amounts of money on cars, which will never be, they'll never get the money back, and they're happy to do it. And if that's you, good luck to you. That's absolutely fine. But just look past the headline. If it's a 30-year-old Bentley that costs £4,000, there's a reason it costs £4,000. And as we were saying earlier, you know, it could end up being the most expensive Bentley that you've ever bought. And you could so easily spend £24,000 on a really nice example and end up way better off than you ever would be with a, you know, with a complete shed. So yeah, I think that's probably my last kind of car. I've got other examples, but I think it makes the point.
Yeah, that's a brilliant example. Okay, well, there you go. Some cars that you really shouldn't buy. It was fun to take a slightly different point of view, wasn't it? And
yeah,
turn it on its head. Okay, well, we've got a good listener question coming up. I told you we'd definitely do one this week. So thank you, Mike Hall, for your question. Before we do that, let me just say, please go and rate and review the podcast. Leave a little review, leave a little rating, 5-star rating, obviously. And also subscribe and follow wherever you listen to or watch the podcast, because that's how we find a bigger audience. Please keep doing that. So the question comes from Mike Hall, who he says that in 1970, he passed his driving test and he had a series of Minis. The third was a 1-litre Mini Cooper that he loved. He modified it. He upgraded it. It was his pride and joy. He says he would absolutely love to be able to drive it now and feel how it compares to those memories. But my question is, are our memories of old loved cars seen through rose-tinted glasses? And would the truth be that they were really bad in reality? So this is all about going back to cars that you loved or owned years and years ago.
Yeah.
Have you done that yourself?
Yeah, I have. And it's a really unsatisfactory answer, because they can be both.
Yeah.
You know, let me give you two examples, both of which I owned when I was young, both of which I have driven quite recently, one of which I owned quite recently. So 205 GTI. I had one of those when I was briefly an idiot in the city in the 1980s, and I loved it then. And when I drove another not that long ago, I loved it so much I bought it, and I kept it for 6-7 years, and that car was absolutely as good as I remembered it to be. In fact, it might have even been a bit better, because, you know, all modern hatchbacks by comparison are so heavy and cumbersome, and no, I absolutely loved it. But Mark 1 Golf GTI, which I also had at the time, I absolutely loved. Go and drive one now. You've done this, haven't you? And it just feels a bit slow, a bit ponderous, and nothing like the icon that it is revered to be. And I'm sorry if, you know, if people listening to this find that, you know, sort of, I don't know, a bit odd that I'm dissing the Mark 1 Golf GTI. It's not a bad car, but it's just nothing like as good. And it's, when you drive one, you kind of think to yourself, well, it's a nice old thing, but you don't want one. You know, nice experience to have, give it back, never think about it again. Whereas in the day, well, you weren't even alive, but, you know, they were absolutely the thing. They had a transformative, I mean, they invented it, well, they didn't invent, but they, you know, because of them, an entire category of cars came into existence. So there is no easy answer. All you can do is just go back and see how you feel, because I've literally had both experiences with cars that I owned when they were new and they were amazing. And one of which I love so much again that I bought it, the other which I just thought, well, yeah, nice old thing.
Yeah, it's probably to do with the specific car, isn't it? And even that, the example of the specific make and model. So, yeah, you just have to go back and try it for yourself. But I'm, so I started in this line of work not quite 15 years ago. It'd be 15 years ago at the end of this year. And so, you know, particularly now that I'm looking for a replacement for my Alpine, I'm wondering what I should buy. And I'm thinking about some of the cars that I drove as a car journalist during the early years of my career. And, you know, the ones that I really loved back then. And there is a part of me that thinks it can only be disappointing to go and revisit these cars now that they have 70, 80,000 miles on them or whatever, now that they are 10, 15 years old. But I don't know. Perhaps I will have more to say on this soon if I start driving a few of these to see what I should put my money into. But I do wonder, you know, when your expectations are really high because of you have some very fond memories, it's almost inevitable that's going to disappoint, isn't it?
Well, except sometimes it doesn't.
Golf
GTI. Yeah, 205 GTI was, you know, completely the reverse. It was great.
Interesting question, though. Thank you, Mike Hall. Please get your questions in, because we like ending the podcast that way. You can either send us a message on social media or email us info@the-intercooler.com. And of course, do go and check out our website, our beautiful new website, the-intercooler.com. And you can sign up and start your free trial. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week.
Thanks. Bye.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.